This is the final episode of the Political Rewind podcast. I'm J.J. Sutherland. Yes, this is the last Political Rewind, but fear not. You can get your political fix on NPR.org from the It's All Politics podcast with Ron Elving and Ken Rudin. The big political story this week was the continued reaction to the release of the so-called torture memos, the legal justification for harsh interrogation techniques used during the Bush administration. Two new Senate reports on the issue were released this week, but even so, by Thursday morning, there were still some unanswered questions.
Today we know far more about the Bush administration's harsh interrogation program than we did a week ago. The Justice Department released more than 100 pages of legal guidance that was given to the CIA, and a Senate committee released a detailed report on the military's use of harsh interrogation methods. NPR's Ari Shapiro provides an overview of the many questions that remain unanswered.
Take out your mental calendar. In March of 2002, the CIA picked up a terrorism suspect named Abu Zubaydah. In August of that year, the Justice Department authorized the CIA to use harsh interrogation techniques on Zubaydah. So here's unanswered question number one from Karen Greenberg of NYU's Center on Law and Security.
What were they doing to him in that intervening period of time? And we don't know.
Abu Zubaydah's description of his treatment is classified. His lawyers have made it clear they believe Zubaydah was tortured before the Justice Department authorized harsh interrogations. So Aziz Huck of University of Chicago Law School wants to know whether the CIA was operating under any kind of legal guidance for those first 5 months that they had Zubaydah.
Are there verbal conversations in which lawyers from the Justice Department are saying, yes, no, these measures are or are not okay? Those communications may never have been reduced to writing, at least until August 2002. But do they exist?
We don't know. In August of 2002, the Justice Department identified the line between harsh interrogations and torture. But one memo shows the CIA crossed that line. Interrogators waterboarded people more than they were supposed to. And there are other instances of people torturing detainees, even using the Bush administration's very limited definition of torture. Professor Greenberg tells the story of one detainee who was interviewed by the International Committee of the Red Cross.
A detainee by the name of Bin Atish, who says that he was shackled with his hands above his head for a two-week-long period. And the memos are specific about shackling, as if you're going to be in that position, being only that way for 2 hours, or your arms can be kept in a different position.
So when it comes to waterboarding and shackling, it seems CIA interrogators went beyond the Justice Department's definition of torture. But those are only narrow slices of information.
I think it's important to find out whether or not the limits, the stated limits, were adhered to or violated as a routine matter.
This is St. John's Law Professor Brian Tamanaha.
I'd like to know how many times people were slammed against the wall.
The Justice Department said more than 30 times, and it's torture.
And I'd like to know how those numbers were kept. Was someone sitting there with a clicker counting each time?
The same goes for shutting someone in a small box or sleep deprivation. Did the hours exceed the legal limit? This information used to be documented. The CIA videotaped many interrogations, but the agency destroyed those tapes. There's an ongoing investigation into the tapes' destruction. Still, ACLU attorney Amrit Singh has hope. She says the CIA's inspector general finished a classified report in 2004.
This report was relating to improprieties within the CIA interrogation and detention program. So we hope that it'll contain factual details of what the CIA was actually doing to its prisoners.
The ACLU has sued to get that report. There's also a question about the whereabouts of the detainees themselves. According to one Justice Department memo, by May of 2005, 94 people were in CIA detention.
14 of those were transferred to Guantanamo, but we don't know what happened to the remainder of them. It appears that dozens of individuals were actually disappeared, possibly to third countries.
And we know almost nothing about what the U.S. has asked other countries to do, says Professor Aziz Huck.
We have bits and pieces of what we're asking Egypt to do, what we're asking Morocco to do, what we're asking Syria to do, what we're asking Pakistan to do. But that part of the puzzle is totally left off the table.
And with all those unanswered questions looming, it becomes clear why the ACLU believes the release of the torture memos is the beginning, not the end, of the process. Ari Shapiro, NPR News, Washington.
By Friday of this week, the torture memos had become a full-blown Capitol Hill firestorm.
President Obama stepped into a political minefield this week when he left open the possibility that Bush administration officials could be prosecuted for authorizing harsh interrogations that some consider torture. Some liberals are clamoring for a special prosecutor. Conservative defenders of the Bush administration accuse the new president of undermining national security. It's just the kind of partisan battle that Mr. Obama said he was hoping to avoid. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
In one of his first acts as president, Barack Obama signed an executive order revoking Bush administration rules on interrogation and limiting future tactics to those allowed in the Army Field Manual. It was an effort to close what the president calls a difficult chapter in U.S. history.
As a general view, I think that we should be looking forward and not backwards. I do worry about this getting so politicized that we cannot function effectively.
But in recent days, Mr. Obama has learned how hard it is to keep that chapter closed. The trouble began when he agreed to declassify documents spelling out the legal rationale for the harsh techniques and providing gruesome details about them. In releasing those Bush administration documents, Mr. Obama said this is a time for reflection, not retribution. But the liberal group MoveOn.org is less forgiving, circulating a petition that demands the appointment of a special prosecutor.
If you torture an individual detainee, you might go to jail. But if you authorize an entire secret torture program, you get off scot-free. America is better than this.
On Tuesday, Mr. Obama took a half step back from his no retribution pledge after telling CIA officers they would not be prosecuted for following Bush administration guidelines. The president said he'd leave it up to his attorney general to decide how to handle the officials who crafted those guidelines.
And I don't want to prejudge that. I think that there are a host of very complicated issues involved there.
That's an understatement. Political analyst Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute says by leaving the door open to prosecution, the president poured gasoline on the political fire.
This is a story that might have been a 2 or 3 or 4 day story that's now going to be a story for weeks or months.
Indeed, conservatives have seized on the issue as a way to regain the initiative. Former Vice President Dick Cheney and other Republicans have criticized the Obama administration for releasing the torture memos. And Cheney has called for the release of other classified documents, which he says will show that the interrogation tactics paid off. A new survey by the Pew Research Center finds nearly half of all Americans believe torture is sometimes or often justified. But Ornstein says the Obama administration seems happy to have Cheney as a foil.
If the face of the Republican Party looking forward is Cheney and Limbaugh, if what you've got is a debate over whether we're for or against torture, that's not a problem for the White House in political terms.
What is a potential problem is the likely effect of the issue on Congress, which may well be distracted from the difficult decisions the president wants made on the budget, health care, energy, and education. Ornstein has seen it before.
There are things that can happen where minor statements or stumbles dominate the discussion for weeks at a time, and you lose your control of the bully pulpit.
In a recent survey, MoveOn members ranked universal health care, economic recovery, and improving schools all as higher priorities than holding the Bush administration accountable for its actions. But Executive Director Justin Rubin says so far 150,000 members have signed the MoveOn petition calling for a special prosecutor.
We think there needs to be a full investigation into the torture programs and that we need to ultimately hold the architects accountable, fundamentally, because that's the only way that we can make sure this doesn't happen again.
But your group is called Move On.
I think this administration has shown that they can walk and chew gum at the same time.
Maybe so. But a rueful White House spokesman, Robert Gibbs, said yesterday, if the president had been worried about sparking a political free-for-all, the events of this week have proven him right. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On a lighter note, this week NPR kicked off a year-long look at people who worked tirelessly in President Obama's old job.
Now, community organizers were, as many people remember, elated when one of their own, Barack Obama, was elected to the White House. Now they're busy trying to influence issues such as health care and jobs. NPR's Pam Fessler is following a group of community organizers this year and takes us this morning to Harrisburg, Virginia.
So is the panel going to be up here?
I was thinking here.
Okay.
We don't need to use the whole room.
Larry Yates and Liz Riggin are arranging the chairs for a community forum on health care reform. He's with a group called the Virginia Organizing Project. She's an intern. They're an interesting pair. She thinks it might be better if the scattered chairs are a bit more organized.
You know, I'm just thinking not.
Really?
See, we had all those sofas and chairs there. I don't know. Do you think it looks too terrible? Yeah. You do.
Yates has been organizing in one form or another since the anti-war protests of the 60s. With his bushy white beard, he looks like a disheveled Santa Claus. Riggin is a social work major at James Madison University. Her interest in community organizing was sparked by her work on the Obama campaign. She knows she has a lot to learn.
Are you here for the healthcare forum?
Yes.
Yes, I'm Liz Riggin.
This is one of 10 forums the Virginia Organizing Project is holding across the state. They're trying to get people to lobby lawmakers for more affordable health care. They've invited local residents, health care providers, and other interest groups. That's what community organizers do, bring people together to try to figure out how to make change.
Hi, how are you doing?
Yates hopes that Riggin will also pick up some pointers tonight. He won't be around forever. Part of his job is to make sure others in the community can take the lead on issues they care about. But right now, both he and Riggin are getting a little nervous because so few people have arrived.
Well, nothing ever starts until 7.5 minutes after it's supposed to.
Okay. That's good to know.
But eventually, people do come. And Riggin is no dummy.
Here comes one of my friends.
She invited her friends.
That's the good thing about social workers. We all support each other. It's very nice to be in that community.
Good evening, everybody, and I really appreciate you coming out, though it's so nasty outside.
About 30 people are here now. Yates tells them that health care reform is possible this year and that they need to be at the table.
And our experience as organizers tells us that the only way it is going to happen is not just because the right guy is president or the right person is in Congress. What will really make the difference is for each one of you and people like you all over the country to raise the level of fuss.
He says lawmakers need to hear directly from their constituents to counter powerful special interests in Washington, and that the most effective message is a personal story. Like a showman, he asks everyone here to say something about themselves, and soon the stories are pouring out.
When I was 15, I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. I'm now 22, and when I turn 23, I won't have health care.
The paperwork I have found, even for those that have coverage, it makes me crazy.
He is now asked to go see a cardiologist. He has no chance in hell of ever paying any of these bills.
Everyone here has a story, and when they're done, Riggin gets to the point of the event.
I have paper and envelope, so tonight before you leave, I would really appreciate it if you'd write a letter. We can send it. I can just pass out the paper now.
Several people start writing their senators and congressmen immediately. They seem really pumped. Afterwards, Riggin declares the meeting a success, although she only has a handful of letters.
Can 30 people change the whole United States? No. But we did this 10 times across the state, and it's being done all across the country. And this is not the first or last event for hardly anybody here.
Yates says the community organizing is a gradual process. It's about making connections and building networks. He says if everyone here talks to a few others, the message will spread. He notes that a local TV station also covered the event, reaching thousands more. Liz Riggin says if there's one thing she's learned about community organizing so far, it's that one has to be flexible and very patient. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
And that's it for Political Rewind. This is the last of its brief but glorious run, but you can still feed your political craving with the It's All Politics podcast at npr.org. I'm JJ Sutherland.